Okay, so.
So are we done yet? No? So we showed a bunch of techniques that improve pointing. And I mentioned it briefly, but back to it because it's an important distinction. There are two categories of approaches. Ones that are target agnostic, they don't need to know where the targets are. So the mass acceleration is one of them. And the ones that are called target aware, they need to know the potential targets in order to work, like symmetric pointing, which we just saw, or the drag and pop. Now, obviously, that it is obvious that if you have access to more information, you can take advantage of that information to make things better. So target-aware techniques are more efficient. The problem is that they're harder to implement in existing systems because applications don't tell the world what their targets are. And as I said, as soon as you start editing text, for example, you have a zillion targets, and every character is a target. So I think this is a tension between having something that can work everywhere but not going to get much benefit, or something that requires more information that, unfortunately, we don't have, that could probably give you quite a bit of an advantage. Now, there are people who said, well, if we don't know the target, let's learn the targets. And we are in the era of learning, deep or not. And so people have been applying machine learning techniques to where people click. Remember this diagram with all these mouse movements and clicks? Well, people have been using image recognition. You take a snapshot of the screen and you recognize, oh, this looks like a button, and people actually seem to click on this. Try to sort of reverse engineer the targets from both the content of the display as a set of pixels and the content and the user input. There are actually interesting papers using these techniques. I think it would be a lot more simpler to have a way to extract targets from existing applications. And in fact, interestingly enough, we've been able to do a lot of that target extraction using the APIs that are available on macOS, on Linux, on Windows as well, for accessibility. Because to have systems that provide accessibility to people with sighting impairments or motor impairments or color blindness or you name it, there are a number of APIs that give you access, for example, to the list of menus and the list of buttons so that a blind person, for example, can have them read to him or her. And so this is a way through which applications are revealing information about what they can do. And then in some systems, you can actually go and explore the tree of widgets on the screen and infer information from that. It's a lot of work that would be made a lot simpler if there was a more standard way to export information about target positions. So I think that's been the problem, is that these techniques need to be implemented by the operating systems manufacturer. They cannot be done really properly purely at the application level, which is unfortunate. Okay, so now we explore the way to improve pointing, but we still have this other issue, which is, well, can we break the limits of Fitts' law, which I said it was about an idea of 12 bits, corresponding to a distance in 1 meter, and here a width of half a millimeter to be the safe side. And the idea is that if distances are too large, or if target sizes are too small, well, we are in an information world. We can manipulate this world. And one thing we can do is zoom in and zoom out. So if you are looking at a Google map, and you're on the map of Paris, and you want to navigate to New York? What are you going to do? Okay, forget searching. I don't like searching. But yes, you're not going to pan for half an hour across the Atlantic, right? That's what you do when you take a flight and it's boring enough. So you're going to zoom out. So you reduce distances on the screen by zooming out. And, you know, on the other hand, if you started in Google Maps again where you see the entire Earth and you want to see, well, where is this bicyclic campus they all talk about, you're not going to see it. It's smaller than the pixel, so you're going to zoom in. Now, what is the performance of zooming in, pointing, sorry, in the zoomable world? I mean, the exact same task of clicking a target can be done in the zoomable world like Google Maps. When we started this work, Google Maps did not exist. It was very hard to convey the idea that things could be zooming in and out, you know, fluidly and etc. Now that Google Maps is here, it's very easy to explain the concept. Because the first work in this notion of zoomable interface was done actually as far back as 1992 or 1993 by Ken Perlin and David Fox with a system called PAD. And PAD was a system where you had a, for example, a calendar. And at first you see the word calendar. But as you zoom in, so I'm not sure what the way for zooming in was at the time, but imagine you do this with a scroll wheel. Instead of scrolling, it's zooming, which it does in Google Maps now. So when you zoom into this word, then suddenly you would see the word sort of fade out, and then the years appear. And then if you do a little panning to get in the middle of the year 92, and then you start zooming in, then this 92 box is what used to be this little rectangle. It's getting bigger. 92 is fading away, and then you start seeing the month. And you get the picture you can get from the months, to the weeks, to the days, to the hour. You can go to the milliseconds if you wanted to. So you can zoom in, and the system reveals details as you need them. This is what maps do. You know, as you zoom in, you get more details. You get countries, and then you get roads, and then you get cities, and then you get individual streets. But you can apply that to any information world. And so here, for example, is a tree that has text. And then you see smaller text here. So you're going to zoom in to be able to read it. And as you zoom in, you realize there's more text inside the tree. And then you can decide to go explore it. And you can keep navigate in this way. So these were called ZUI, zoomable user interfaces, successor of GUIs. Have you experienced zoomable user interface other than maps? Yes? No? Yes?
I guess you can share any, a Blender zoomable interface, yes.
The what?
You can zoom in Blender.
Blender, yes. Okay. Model, 3D modeling. Okay.
So some like more complex structures that cannot be fit into one picture, such as I remember in biology class we had like the hierarchy of all the different animals, and then like it's a lot of stuff, right? So you
the
can
tree
basically
of life?
Yeah, it's like a tree also.
Yeah, okay.
Prezi,
but that's
yeah.
Thank you. So there's a system called Prezi. Which allows you to make presentations, so you can look P-R-E-Z-I. It allows you to do slideshows, but where you navigate by zooming in and out. And in fact, Prezi is really inspired not by PAD itself, but by its successor, I don't have it here, PAD++, which had a slideshow system where you could put slides in this kind of arrangements where you had a slide and then you would zoom in the corner of the slide and there was another slide and then you could navigate, etc. So Prezi is a good example. Now, back to theory. How do we represent a zoomable interface in a way that, that allows us to think about what it means to point and navigate this space. George Furness and Ben Peterson came up with this notion of space scale diagram, which is a way to represent a 2D world. XY is the 2D world, it's one plane. And the third axis is the échelle, French for scale. So the same world, the same image, can be seen at different scale as we go up and down. So here, at scale zero, everything is a big bang, everything is a dot. But as I zoom, as I go up the scale, I see the world bigger and bigger. Now here, I've taken a single world, a single word, zoom, and I made it bigger, but you could imagine that as you go to higher scales, you have more details, like a map, right? So it's useful to represent the fact that the same space, and I will say information space, but you can think map if that helps, is seen at different levels of scale with more or less detail. Now, the view that you have in that world, it does not change size when you go up and down the scale. So if I have, if I start at high scale here, my window is on the bar of the Z. I only see, you know, this bar in the middle here. As I zoom out, zooming out means going down, my window stays the same size, but now it contains the entire letter Z. And if I continue, it will contain Z and O. And then at this point, I may say, oh, I'm going to be panning. Panning is moving my window horizontally in that space at the same scale. I'm going to the end of the word. And now I'm going to zoom in. And the M is going to now overflow the window. And then I can get to the branch M. So what I'll see on the screen is the piece of the Z, the letter Z, Z-O-O, panning, getting to the end of the word, then zooming in, letter M, and the branch of the letter M. Are you all familiar with that?
Yes.
You had a question?
It's not a question. There's something similar in the museum in Trocadero. So if somebody...
Oh, yeah. I haven't been to that museum.
The Museum of Man.
Museum of Man.
Yes.
Yeah, Museum of Human.
Yeah, I mean that.
Now, the interesting thing is that we can visualize this as a trajectory in that space, right? Now, it turns out that in this space-scale diagrams, the shortest path to go from here to here is not the straight line. That would be paddling across the Atlantic in Google Maps. The faster way is to zoom out and then zoom in while adjusting your trajectory. So this is a non-Euclidean space for those mathematically inclined. Something we are normally not used to. We tend to think as the shortest path to a place as a straight line. Now the thing that is fascinating to me is that we, even though you know, we don't have a previous experience of zoomable worlds until we've encountered them on the computer. It's not part of our natural world. Once you understand how zooming works, spontaneously you will use those trajectories. You will do the zoom back and zoom in. Yes. And so what we did with my good friend and colleague Yves Guillard is we set up a simple zoomable environment where we had people start in the position in that space, zoomable space, and we had a target somewhere else. The world, in fact, had concentric circles around the target. So it's if you have concentric circles, you always know where to go to find the target. And we did a pointing task. We said, well, go point to find the target and point at it when it's big enough on the screen. And you remember that natural pointing is limited by an ID of about 10, 12. Well, we went to IDs around 33. Now, an idea of 33, make it 32, 2 to the power of 32 ratio between the distance and the size. I think we looked at it, and it's like you are starting in Paris, and you want to go to New Zealand, which is the furthest part of Earth from France. You want to go to New Zealand and pick a particular petal of a particular flower in a particular garden of Auckland. That's the difficulty of the task in terms of the ratio between the distance you have to cover, about 20,000 kilometers, and the size of the object you're picking, which is less than a centimeter. And what happened is that when we measured movement time according to index of difficulty, we still got this amazingly aligned set of points. So Fitt's law, the good old Fitt's law, didn't know it was going to put through the paces of a zoomable interface, still holds in an environment where you're not just moving your arm towards a target that you can see in your field of view. You're doing this weird, you know, zooming out, zooming in, finding the target, boom, clicking, and it's still governed by the same law. Now, to a question, we looked at the time to zoom out and zoom in, and as one would expect, if you observe yourself doing this kind of thing, is you zoom out very quickly, because you don't need precision when you zoom out. It's like throwing your arm at the beginning of the movement. You zoom out quickly. When you zoom in, you have to be very careful, because if you zoom in too fast and the target flies out of the screen, it's like you lost it. And you need to zoom out again to recover the target, etc. And so we actually made a parallel between this pan and zoom in phase with, we use a tunnel, but I think a bridge would be a better analogy. You want to drive on a bridge that doesn't have fences on the side, and you want to fall off the bridge. If you fall off the bridge, you lost the target. So you want to stay on that bridge while going as fast as possible, which I don't recommend doing in real life. And I'll get back to this analogy because, in fact, we were able to provide a theoretical explanation of why we had this regularity here and this Fitt's law. Then we looked at something I think, again, this was done in, 94, 95 maybe, maybe a bit later. Anyway, before we had watches and small screens and smartphones and all that, we were looking at the effect of the size of the view. Because if you again think of Google Maps, if I make you do a pointing task on your laptop or desktop screen, or if I have you do it on your smartphone or even your watch, it's not going to be as effective if the screen is smaller. Because when the screen is smaller, this risk of losing your target is higher. Right? So we measured the effect of view size, and not going into too much detail here, we found that, in fact, movement time, in a certain limit of validity, if view is sufficiently large, we didn't see an effect. But when it becomes very small, movement time is proportional to ID as before, divided by view size, which is an interesting relationship when you design interfaces that are meant to run on small displays. Okay, so the interesting point here is that Fitt's law applies to a situation where the means you have to do the pointing are very different from the original type of movement, which I think reinforces this idea that it's all about information and exchanging or transmitting information. When you're moving your arm, you have one way to transmit information, which is controlling your limbs. When you're in a zoomable world, it's a different set of commands, but it all boils down to the same sort of limitation we have in our ability to input information about where we are and output information about where we're going. And I think I mentioned that before, but I have a student who's finishing her thesis on information theory and HCI. And in fact, she will do a TA session about this to tell you more and to have you experience it by yourself. Okay, so zoomable interfaces are good. I guess that's a short story. This is work that was done also by people from our group, Carolina Per, I mentioned before. Jean-Daniel Fekett is another former student of mine, is now leading a group doing information visualization, and he will be teaching in the InfoVis class. So they did this system to facilitate scrolling very long documents. So the document they took was the entire set of plays, I think there are 15 of them, of Shakespeare. That's kind of a long text. And how do you navigate this text? And they created OrthoZoom. The idea is that you have a scroll bar, but a scroll bar to navigate 50,000 lines, not really easy. And so it's called OrthoZoom because if you're moving along the scroll bar, you're scrolling. But if you're moving your cursor horizontally, you're controlling the zoom. So if I go, I believe, to the left, I'm going to zoom out. And so I had all the lines of the plays here. The interesting thing about plays is there is structure. There are acts and there are scenes and there are etc. So as you zoom out, of course, the text becomes unreadable, but you get the higher level information, like you know, which scene and which act or who is speaking, etc. So you can zoom in and out and scroll up and down. They compared to what at the time was the best method for scrolling long documents, which was called SDAS. What SDAS was doing is that it only had the vertical control of the scroll bar, but it adjusted the zoom factor to how fast you scrolled. So it's speed-dependent automatic zooming because it was zooming for you. In OrthoZoom, you control the zoom. And they compared the two, and boom, OrthoZoom was twice as fast as that. And when we get these kind of results, we are very happy. Because getting something twice as fast as anything that's been done before is not every day, so it was a very good result. And it tells us something also that, you know, sometimes you try to make interfaces that do a lot more for you. But in fact, this is an example that shows that if you give the right control to the user, giving more control can actually help make the user a lot more efficient than an automatic technique. And so, I mean, there have been a number of other works around the zoomable interface, but there's also work on trying to understand these basic laws of movements. Trying to really, I mean, in a sense, we're building this very sophisticated application, this very sophisticated environment, you know, whether it's virtual worlds or plain classic editing applications or games or you name it. And we don't know that much about sort of basic actions that we do. So Fitts' law itself is still papers that are debating what should be the formula for Fitts' law. And in particular, Fitts' law, the original experiment and the way we often try to use the pointing paradigm is 1D pointing. Fitts, if you remember the original device, it had two vertical bands and you pointed left, right. So it was unidirectional. It didn't matter if you, you know, if you went up or down. It was a vertical strip, so it was only the width that was counting. Now, on our screens, we have 2D targets. Usually they are rectangles, sometimes different shapes, but let's stick with rectangle. So when I'm pointing at a rectangle, what is the width? If I have a vertical rectangle like this, and I come from an angle, which is what we do all the time, right? I mean, every time you go to a menu, you arrive from an angle, what is the width? Is it the smaller size of the rectangle? Is it this the length of the intersection of the angle here. So people have come up with a bunch of formulas here with more and more Greek letters to try to capture that. And as far as I can tell, nobody has really demonstrated a formula that is so much better than the others. Or rather, when they have a formula that is better, meaning provides a better fit for the experimental data, they usually have a lot more parameters. So of course, if you add parameters, you're going to get a better fit, but you're not really solving the problem. So, okay, still a lot of stuff on Fitts' law, and there's a lot of theoretical stuff beyond the formula itself that I don't have time to go into. Then, when PDA started to happen, and the idea of interacting with a pencil or stylus, because at the time that was the way people thought we would use those handheld devices, it became clear that pointing with a stylus was not really as good as pointing with a mouse. First of all, when you tap the screen with a stylus, it's going to slip, right? Most of the time. So what does it mean if you're trying to tap a target and it slips? Do you take the point where you started, or do you interpret the slip as you wanted to, in fact, miss or cancel? So Johnny Acott and Shuminzai, the same Shuminzai we've seen before, came up with the idea of goal passing and crossing. The idea that to select an object, you don't point inside of it, but the object has a vertical line, they call it goal, and what you need is to tap on one side, cross, and lift. Which with a stylus is something actually very natural, even with your finger. What they showed is that, in fact, Fitts' law, once again, won the game, and if you call W this time the height of the goal rather than the width of the target. The height of the goal, of course, if the goal is very small, it's going to be harder to cross it. Well, the ID expressed in the traditional way would still work, and Fitts' law still govern goal passing. And I'll show you an example where researcher François Gambottier, who's a French researcher who works in the US, created an entire interface based on this crossing interaction. And then, so the same Johnny Acott here looked at the task of traversing a tunnel. Although, as I said, I prefer calling it a bridge, but anyway. The idea here is you have this rectangle, and your task is to enter it at the one end, to stay inside the whole time, and to exit at the other end. So now we have a new parameter because we have not only well, we have the width, and the amplitude now is the length of the tunnel. Now, why look at this? Can you think of a task you do that requires this kind of guided movement? Drawing, yes. Yes, some scroll bars don't like you to leave the scroll bar, and that's true. And there's one more.
Menus,
hierarchical menus. You go on a menu, and then you need to go in the submenu, and on some systems and most of web pages, which drives me absolutely crazy, you have to stick to the, otherwise, boom, you lose your selection. So what Johnny showed is that the movement time to do this task is in fact proportional. There's no log anymore to the A, which we had called D until now, the amplitude over width. He even generalized that to an arbitrary tunnel of arbitrary shape and arbitrary changing width, with a formula that is a bit more complicated because you need a curvilinear integral of the curvilinear abscissa over the width for this abscissa. And if you apply this to this rectangle, you get this. The way he actually came up with this formula is very interesting because he said, well, it started with goal passing. Imagine I forget about the middle part, but I have one goal here, one goal here. So my task is crossing that and then crossing that. And you can apply Fitts' law and you get a value. Then say, oh, I'm going to put an additional goal in the middle here. So now you have to cross the first one, the second one, and the third one. And you look at the formula by applying the goal passing thing. And then you divide it again in two. And so once you have a zillion goals here, you get your tunnel. And in fact, if you read the paper, you'll see that if you integrate this over an infinity of goals, you get that. So it's a case where the math and the psychology say the same thing, which frankly is not that often the case. So you could derive that formula from this notion of crossing an infinity of goals. And then when he ran an experiment, it was verified by the experimental data. And in fact, coming back to my multiscale pointing, when we looked at this data, we used the steering law. By applying it to the zoom in part, where at every step you need to zoom in while maintaining the target close enough to the center so you don't lose it. Because each time you zoom more, if your target is not the center, it's going to drift more and more. So you really want to keep it in the center. And so it's like the target is the end of the tunnel, and you want to stay close enough to the center to get to the end. And by applying the steering law to this path in this space scale diagram here, we actually showed that it resulted in Fitts' law for multiscale navigation. So the thing to make of that is when you find this kind of empirical laws, it means there's something in terms of human behavior, human control, that is very strong behind it. And that means it's something you can build on to create and invent technique, and it also gives you tools to facilitate the evaluation of new techniques. So, as I said, this crossing type of interaction was used by Greg Apitz and François Gambottier as advisor to create this system Crossy. I have a video I'm going to show. The idea here is this looks like a tool palette where you would tap. But in fact, no. Each tool here has a little goal. It's just visualized with these two little dots around it. So to select it, you cross over it, that direction or that direction. The interesting thing is when you cross, you can actually keep your pencil or stylus down to select something else. So here, when you select the search tool here, which allows you to select strokes. This is a hand drawing tool. So you want to select stroke by their color, by their thickness. In a traditional interface, you would tap here. This comes as a dialog box. You say, oh, I want to select red strokes, and then I want to replace them with blue strokes. So you would have tap, tap, tap. Here, what you can do is start crossing from the left. This shows up. Then you need to go here to the red thing, cross that one. Here you can then go to find, and then replace, and then go to the blue. And then in one stroke, without lifting the pen, you've selected all these parameters. So the argument of the authors here is that the crossing type of interaction is more fluid because you can leave your stylus down or your finger down to select a bunch of things, which also will probably reinforce muscle memory and kind of things. So, for example, here they show that you can find and replace, find and replace, find and replace just by circling instead of doing click, click, click like you would do on a traditional interface. So it's an interesting, you know, take on very standard type of interaction They also showed how the scroll bar could work differently, etc. Well, here, so here are the examples of selecting a pen and then thickness and color. This was the find and replace I talked about. This is the find replace multiple times, etc. And all the gestures you can do on the scroll bar. So it's sort of, remember I talked about gesture-based interfaces and how hard they were to discover. In a sense, this is a different type of almost gesture-based interface where the gestures are guided by this goal passing task. But in the end, you probably remember the shape of the gesture more than the actual targets you're hitting on the way. Okay, conclusion, and we have time for a couple of videos. So you would think by now we've figured out this business of pointing and we'll be done with it, but no, there's still research going on. We're still far from optimal. There's still things that can be done at the operating system level, at the application level. FitFlow is incredibly robust. In fact, when I was working with Yves Guillard, he used to tell me, you know, FitFlow is not just about pointing. I bet you that if you do a task where you play a note, a note pitched to a person, and you ask them to start whistling from a particular pitch to that target pitch, the time to do that will also be governed by FitFlow. And that's why the link with information theory is particularly interesting to me. But anyway, very robust, which is a good thing. It's too bad there's only one of those, pretty much, in all of HCI. And yes, it's linked to information, which information you put on the screen to help the visual system understand what's clickable and where to go, what of that information is perceived by the user, the information produced by the motor system when you issue commands to say do this, do that, and the information that is effectively captured by the system, which is used to achieve the task. And there is obviously information that is lost between what's on the display and what you actually perceive. There is also information that is lost between or errors that are inserted between the information you produced by the motor system and the one actually captured by the system. And so that gives you a lot of possible ways to improve these basic fundamental tasks. Okay, so what else did I have to show you here? Okay, so here's PAD++. So we'll see an interface where you can pan, and then you can zoom around the cursor position. So we see that there is another drawing, and I can pan again, and zoom again, and under the T there is more text, and you see that things get revealed as you go, and things get fade out if they are too big scale. So it's absolutely fractal, and there's no reason to stop at any point. It could be infinite if you know how to implement it. So there will be other links for PAD and PAD++. I don't have videos of the original PAD. This is OrthoZoom. Okay, so actually zooming out is on the right, which I always found confusing. So you see the text disappearing. Now we are at the level of acts and plays. I can scroll at this level, and then I go left, and then I reveal detail. And as I reveal detail, I can adjust to get to the particular part I was looking for. So this only works for text that has structure, because if it doesn't have structure, you zoom out and all you get is this gray band. It's not giving you any information. But most long texts have structure. otherwise, there wouldn't be many people to read them. So what they added too is when you get to the level of having this higher level structure, there is snapping that happens. So the thing that is highlighted in yellow If you were to lift the button, release the button at this point, that's where you would go immediately at the detail level. So we are in Act 5, 3, well, we missed it. But anyway, there was this notion of snapping so you could get shortcuts. You didn't have to zoom back in all the way and risk losing the point you had in mind. So anyway, so there'll be more examples in the full video. This is Crossy. So the beginning is not very interesting because it's not Crossy. So here we start.
Based solely on crossing. In our application, named Crossy, basic interaction steps are strokes made through crossing widgets. These steps can be fluidly composed, as here, when we select the color and width of the pen in one stroke. In the next scenes, we display the normally invisible pen strokes on the widgets. Our system uses a tool palette with 5 buttons. Each tool, like the highlighter and the eraser, can be selected by crossing them from right to left. Other kinds of buttons are provided as well. To access them, we open the pen dialog box by extending the stroke outside the pen button. Here we see several radio buttons. We cross them from right to left to select the characteristic of a pen. As shown here, the layout of our windows makes it easy to select several attributes in one stroke. In Crossy, the left and bottom borders of dialog boxes are used to validate the selection, while the top and right borders are used to cancel a selection.
So if you go up, you cancel. If you exit to the
This makes it easy for the user to call the dialog box, select the parameters, and validate in one stroke. We also offer checkbox functionality, where several options can be selected at once by crossing them vertically.
So you can see, I just wanted to show the... Yes?
Doesn't look that good. I mean, every time the user seems to want to select an option, it looks like he has to struggle to not choose anything else. Like, between two currents,
he's
going to pick something, then he's going to shift...
We'll now...
Yeah, no, you have to go around things. Yeah, but I mean, here they're showing the way to do it in one stroke. You can also do it in multiple strokes. So you can lift and then go directly to the next. I agree that the layout is probably not optimal for the things they do. And, you know, this is an area for research, but I think the example of the
Crossy's find and replace
of the find and replace is actually interesting, because here you're selecting what you want to find, thickness and color. You find, you replace, you say what you want to find and replace, which you will remember for the next time around. Then you find another thing, and then you can replace with something else. Give me the, and now you can keep finding, replacing, and if you actually go backwards, it will undo the replace and the find. So you circle this way to go forward and this way backward, which I think is a clever idea. And I guess you could design more of these things to support these continuous gestures. But I agree it's not perfect. And this is just one research project that would be... interesting to continue. I wanted to show one more thing because this was a video that was pretty popular at the time where, you know, we're used to this desktop. Well, this is to show that our desktops are messy and our computer desktops are, if not clean, at least have limited functionality. And so here they created this virtual desktop where it had this physical feel to it, where you could throw objects and they would bump into each other and you could make messy piles and move things around. And so it's to show that there is really a range of basic skills that we have that could be used in designing new forms of basic interactions. Now, of course, when things are in a mess like this, at some point you want to tidy them up. And so part of the of what BumpTop is doing is, so yeah, that's the
the gesture to select a bunch of things and tidy them up into a pile, and then you can navigate the pile and find things in the pile and sort. So it has a very rich set of commands, all done with a pencil at the time, because it was a dominating type of touch interface. So anyway, I'll let you watch the entire video. The link will be online. And I think we're going to call it a day because it's time. Are there any pending questions? Yes? No? Interesting? Not interesting? Yes? Okay. Thank you. I'll see you next week. And have fun.